Welcome to Australia's Fiercely Independent Property Podcast.
Residential property is the only asset class we live in. It is where we raise our families, and it's our most expensive investment, yet property advice remains unregulated.
Listen to three pioneers of the property industry, each with diverse areas of expertise in property planning, buying, and education.
We'll distill the raw truth from the ill-informed.
Join the property planner, David Johnston, the property buyer, Kate Bakos.
That's me.
And the property professor, Peter Kalizos, as we take you on a journey through the maze of property, mortgage and money decisions to empower you to create your ideal lifestyle.
Welcome everyone to the Property Planner, Buyer and Professor podcast. It's lovely to have you back again. And we do have a very interesting topic this week, as we do every week. But there's certainly been a lot of research done by Kate and Dave. And our topic for today is Australia's economy is highly dependent on China. Do you see immediate risk in the housing market should China reduce dependency on the Australian supply chain? So basically, we're talking about the impact of China on Australia's housing market, but we'll also be talking about the macroeconomic situation because that has a big impact on Australian residential property in particular. But before we do that, let's have a quick chat to my two lovely co-hosts. Kate, how are you?
I'm well, Pete, and it's nice to be back here in the normal studio, not in my dining room. And now that we're out, we've had the busiest couple of days that I've had in history here, and it was really all, I think, a result of the situation that we found ourselves in here in Melbourne. We had 3 weeks' worth of essentially limited inspection activity, so I'd banked up a lot of searches for our clients and a lot of good properties for them to go out and see. And of course they hit the ground running and there's a lot of pent up energy. And I had a request for lots of properties of interest to go and inspect them. So yeah, it's been a very, very busy 48 hours, that's for sure.
So last Saturday, were there auctions in person or not?
Last Saturday, we could have auctions in person. I actually didn't though. I had some open for inspections, but it's still, you know, very, very difficult to coordinate. You've got a limited number of people through a property. You've got your PPE, which we all know and are quite fine with, but it was the need to book our clients in individually and make sure that it was registered. The agent acknowledged it. We had QR codes there. It was just, I think, a very enormous task for the agents to have to deal with, and they did it really well.
Okay. Dave, how are you going?
Yeah, I'm going well, Pete.
Remember, we're not talking about sport. We're not talking about that big change to your coach this week.
You two are walking on thin ice.
They saw him out on a high, didn't they, Pete?
Oh, huge game.
Okay, so we've had Dave's update. Let's talk about Chinese investors.
You've had your turn, Dave.
Yeah, well done. See you next week. All right. I'm going well. Thanks, Pete. My market update for this week, the Consumer Sentiment Westpac Melbourne Index is out. And very interestingly, there's a line within it called the Time to Buy a Dwelling Index. And for the first time in a year, that's dropped beneath 100, which means sentiment has actually become negative, that now is a good time to buy a property. So that's a pretty big move because this has been a pretty forward-looking indicator on what's happened with the property market. It actually moved into 100, interestingly enough, in May last year, well before the market actually turned. So it's the fifth month in a row it's declined. Its high in November was 132, and it's down to 96.1.
What are the alternatives there, Dave? If they're not going to buy property, what are they doing? Putting it in the bank or buying shares or something, are they?
They're waiting.
Right.
Waiting, yeah. It's a really interesting measure. And I would argue that at my coalface, I'm not feeling it. But when I look at my website traffic and inquiry, it showed a peak in November, which is absolutely reflecting that sentiment. And it hasn't really come off hard of late, but it certainly has come off a little bit. And there's mixed feelings out there about interest rates increasing. I say to people, we are in a low interest rate environment for a long time in my view, but there's still stories and headlines out there. So people are thinking forward about that. They're also nervous about the incentives finishing at the end of this financial year and what that could mean. And people are also wondering if there's merit in waiting for the spring market, particularly in our big auction cities. And I always think there's merit in celebrating spring. But, yeah, it's an interesting time for a lot of people.
Yeah, I reckon it's quite an early indicator, Pete. So I think just because it's under 100 doesn't mean, you know, the market's going to straight away, you know, drop and even start going negative. I think that's going to take months. There's people who could answer who are actually looking to buy, and they could answer it's not a great time right now, and that's because they've been chasing the market, but they're actually still aiming to buy and will, you know, end up buying. So it certainly is a forward indicator. And, you know, I guess the government and probably many of us would be hoping that this slowly flows through and means that APRA doesn't need to step in as well to restrict lending. But I would suspect it'll take at least 3 to 6 months to flow through to actual significant reduction in price increases. And I'm not saying prices even going backwards, but just the rate of growth, you know, really pulling back.
Good point you make about being a very much a forward indicator, because there's a number of other leading indicators that many commentators use, like planning approvals and finance approvals. I find planning approvals a little bit unreliable, because you can go and get planning approval to either build one house or a, you know, a group of units. But if you don't get the finance, then it's not going to happen. So I think a good leading indicator is finance approvals rather than approvals for building. But yeah, it'll be good to watch that space and see how it all pans out.
I mean, even if we look at last year, just quickly on it, May 20, it started to go into positive territory last year, but the market didn't really move till about November. So people could think, okay, rates are really low. I feel like, you know, it's a good time to buy a property, but I don't have the courage to buy a property because we're in the early stages of a pandemic. So it still took 6 months for that sentiment to actually turn into reality, if you like, in the marketplace. So it'll be interesting to watch it this time around.
Very good. Thank you very much for that, Kate and Dave. So let's get stuck into our topic for today, how China may affect our housing market in particular. So, Dave, the G7 have just finished meeting. So what could you get out of the most recent meeting in regards to our topic today?
The question is, Australia's economy is highly dependent on China, and that certainly is the case. And obviously there's been some concerns about their choosing to not import and put significant tariffs on some of our goods. The G7 is a meeting of supposedly, you know, seven of the wealthiest, largest democracies and Western democracies, so Canada, France, Germany, Italy, the UK, US and Japan. Australia was one of three or four guests invited to join, and I suppose I raise this because there were, in their communique, there were some comments relating to China about potential market distorting economic practices, also putting together an initiative for an infrastructure scheme to rival Beijing's Belt and Road Initiative. And there was comments around the support that for the stand that Australia is taking in standing up for liberal democratic principles in our own region. So, look, certainly don't want to get political here at all, but in reference to the question, Australia's economy is highly dependent on China, and do we see immediate risk pertaining to the housing market? I guess the G7 has basically provided some commentary to say they would support a country like Australia if there is some risk that, you know, we're being forced to, or other countries potentially, to pay higher tariffs in what potentially is an unfair fashion. So that obviously would support the question that they're, you know, our ability to manage our risk or our dependence on China, which primarily through the exporting of our iron ore, which we can talk about as well throughout the episode.
So what we've got there is commentary on a number of different things. And yes, China is one of us, maybe probably Australia's largest trading partner. But I think a catalyst for the G7 was when Boris Johnson and Scott Morrison got together to talk about the UK-Australia Free Trade Agreement. Now, it doesn't mean much for the UK. Apparently, it's only going to increase their GDP by 0.2%, so hardly anything. But certainly that trade agreement will help our economy, and if there is some sort of negative impact from the Chinese government's impost on tariffs, that will help. But I was speaking to, and I can't mention any names, and I'm not going to say anything that's confidential, but, and if you Google this, you'll find this out. It's very well known that the Chinese government has placed a tariff on things like barley, wine, lobster, and other goods. So I was talking to somebody who should know on the weekend, and they said that in 2020, the United Arab Emirates was the largest exporter of grain. Now, I don't know if you've been to Dubai or Abu Dhabi or the UAE, but when I've flown over, I've never seen any paddocks with grain in it. So what's been happening is Australia has been exporting the grain to the UAE, and then it goes from the UAE to other places, including China. And with our wine, you know, when you look at the fine print, we're not allowed to send any bottled wine, but we send it in large containers, and then they bottle it. So, you know, the headline is, you know, tariffs on all of our really important exports. But when you read between the lines, you can see that there are loopholes that we are using to get around that. So because we've had this issue for a number of months, and certainly from the economic or housing point of view, I haven't seen an impact yet. But yes, we still need to keep in mind that China is Australia's largest customer. Not only customer, but largest customer.
Yeah, I think it's a good point, Pete. I mean, it really is iron ore. I think it might be like 70% of our exports or something like that. It for the nation, and you know, unfortunately, I'm sure there's definitely been some businesses who have been affected by those other tariffs. But overall, the country hasn't been affected because we send over so much iron ore to them. Plus, the price of iron ore has hit record highs, which has ultimately shored up, you know, Australia's coffers.
So, Kate, what's your opinion there?
Look, I think when we circle back to what we all do, we are all working in the property and or finance industry, we've got to ask ourselves, you know, what the impact of Chinese investment has been and what the impact of Chinese-born Australians and second generation has been for our property market, because we've got a really diverse number of cities, regional and capital, and we bump into Chinese purchases all the time. And so, you know, working here in Melbourne, I certainly get to see my fair share of Chinese bidders, and I get to work with Chinese buyers. And I think that we can really talk about what we're finding at the coalface. But before we go into that, you know, what makes Australia such an exciting destination for Chinese buyers? And for that matter, I know we're talking China in this podcast, but to read a report that was generated when COVID was breaking and all of the headlines were suggesting that Australia would be plunged into recession, there was a Knight Frank wealth report, and it says it found that Australia is the fourth most popular residential property market after the US, UK and Singapore, with ultra-high net worth Asian cross-border property investors. Now, we're obviously a very attractive destination, and interestingly, since COVID, we've seen property purchasing and ways that we can make due diligence decisions, you know, really expanded, because we've had to embrace technology and think outside of the square when we've not been able to inspect in person. And that certainly hasn't dampened enthusiasm in terms of how attractive our market is. But there's another interesting stat that I picked up, and it talks about just how much the ability for foreign investment has been slowed down by Australia and our state governments derailing the attractiveness for a certain number of purchases. So NAB's fourth quarter of a 2020 residential property survey showed the overall market share of foreign buyers fell to 4% in new property markets, the lowest result since the survey began tracking the data in 2010. Now, that is interesting, but it's not a surprise because, as you both know, state and federally, we've introduced a lot of harsh taxes on all foreign investors for lots of different reasons. So I think we have to look at, from a macro point of view, what the overall impact is to our nation, but from a micro point of view, how that impacts certain markets and certain dwelling types and certain places of residence for everyone who's impacted by these tax changes.
It's a great example, Kate. It shows how we, in essence, I guess the data suggests we've weaned ourselves off the reliance on overseas buyers to drive our property market. I remember when that was first brought in, there was at that particular time, I can't remember the years, but it was when the market was flying and the governments were looking at ways they could slow down the property market. And the state governments in particular obviously raised taxes on foreign buyers, and those numbers just tell us how the number of foreign buyers has reduced significantly, yet the property market still kept ticking along, hasn't it? So, you know, we're not as reliant on foreign buyers as some people might think, but obviously once someone gets a permanent residency, they then can purchase here. So it potentially means, you know, some people need to wait a little bit longer than they would have had to otherwise. So it certainly hasn't had the devastating impact or that some people might fear. And that was the other thing I was going to say is, you know, there's no doubt we are a destination nation, and once international migration begins post-COVID at some point, people are going to be lining up at the door to get back into to get into Australia and then ultimately buying our residential property.
Yeah, I do think when we look at the origination of some of these tax changes, you know, whether it's the introduction of the vacancy tax or it's lifting up the tax on stamp duty, or if we're lifting the land tax rates, we've got all kinds of taxes here that, you know, moderately nasty and certainly aimed to cool some segments of the market. And I remember prior to 2017 when we had some markets racing, and of course, you know, the media will pick up on this and the politicians will pick up on it. When the market is moving faster than first home buyers can manage, there'll always be someone that they are out for, whether it's the investors, we've got to do something about the investors, whether it's the foreign buyers or it's overseas money. We see lots of defending reasons to introduce headlines, and then when we look at these taxes, they certainly did cool segments of the market. I had a friend working as a sales agent in Melbourne's leafy eastern suburbs, and I remember him saying just how hard it was because the value shift for all of his vendors was palpable, and that was largely in response to some of these taxes, you know, really triggering a downturn in interest from overseas buyers in their market.
Just a quick reminder, you can access our show notes, including links to all of the resources we talk about, on our website, which is propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au.
One of my students has just finished writing a dissertation, and the title is Which Strategies Could Be Used to Attract Chinese Investors to the Australian Residential Property Market Based on Non-Capital Factors, in particular Education? And I just want to quote just one section here, just so people get a better idea as to why Chinese people want to directly invest in property. So generally, you're talking about the Chinese government and the Chinese nation and its impact on the housing market. But here are some reasons why Chinese people are passionate about overseas real estate. They include their desire for better quality living conditions, limited domestic financial investment channels, so there are more opportunities here in Australia than in China, security and flexibility of real estate investment, you know, our Torrens title system, where you own freehold property. Here's an interesting one, here's a cultural one, basic prerequisites for marriage. I was watching Stan Grant on China Today last night, and I know in the Greek culture, in the old days, you know, part of the dowry was to have some real estate. That's not so much anymore in modern day, but obviously it's still a thing in China. Here's another cultural one, positive impact on personal face and reputation. A bit like in Australia, if you were to say you own a holiday house in on the French Riviera or a villa in
anywhere
in
overseas.
Yeah.
I think another one is currency hedging too, isn't it? Often.
Yeah, certainly. Those that are more financially savvy would see that as a great advantage. But it was great to get a, and this is just, you know, one section of Li Zhang's dissertation, But it's great to get her perspective, because not only is she from China, but she's also, she's doing a master's, but she used to be a teacher. So she really understands the value that the Chinese community put on education and why they are so keen to send their kids, not just to university. They start with sending them here to high school and maybe some of them even primary school. So, and I can't see that changing in the very near future. So, yeah, that's very insightful. And hopefully before the end of the episode, I'll find some other insightful quotes.
Yeah. How lucky are you getting a dissertation? That's awesome.
Yeah. So, Dave, you mentioned iron ore before, which is very important. What about some of the other commodities? Because Australia seems to survive on digging stuff up and sending it off somewhere.
We certainly do. We're a very fortunate nation because we've got such a large land mass relative to our population size. And I think that's ultimately what underpins our wealth as a nation. It's one of the core reasons we are such a fortunate nation. You know, there's 25 million or so of us, where many other countries have 100 million up to a billion spread around the same amount of land. And so, you know, if you look at our history, it's quite interesting in terms of our top exporting levels and reliance. Wool was our core export right through to 1965. And, you know, proportionately, we were exporting and more reliant on wool every single year from 1901 to 1965 than we are on iron ore today.
So that saying, we, you know, living off the sheep's back.
we didn't have MacArthur on the back of the $10 note for nothing.
we literally did. So iron ore is about 20-odd% of our overall export revenue, whereas wool through that period only barely ever dropped below 30% and was at times higher than 40%. So, look, the point there is that we have transitioned before and, you know, it went from wool to wheat, then coal for about three decades, and now iron ore is our primary source. So I think back to the question, China is looking to, I guess, because they're as reliant on us as we are on them. And it's an important thing for everyone to remember. If we said, oh, we're going to stop shipping iron ore to China, it would have a disastrous impact on their economy because they're so reliant on it. I think China buys about 70% of our iron ore exports, which in turn makes up 60% of all their imports.
Yeah, okay? So they'd have to source it from elsewhere, and that would obviously stimulate other pressures.
Yeah, exactly. And there just isn't the ability to source it from elsewhere at the moment. You know, Australia is the primary supplier of high-grade iron ore, and that's likely to be the case for, from what I've read, at least 5 years, but maybe up to a decade. In Guinea, in Western Africa, there's a huge opportunity to produce iron ore, and it could produce up to 150 million tonnes per year, but the infrastructure would need to be built. And there are all sorts of challenges with that. So they need to build a railway, which includes 39 bridges, 1,000 culverts, 13 passing sidings, 28 kilometres of tunnel, and it also runs through where about 10,000 people live in terms of the proposed tracks.
And not just to focus on that infrastructure requirement, but also geographic proximity. You know, there's we're a bit closer.
Yeah, no, exactly. So the point is, and there's other facts like that which I could share, but the point is that they're as reliant on us as we are on them, and that's with regards to iron ore, and that's likely to be the case for at least 5 years and maybe up to 10 years.
So even if we just consider that particular point, then because we're so dependent on each other, I mean, we can talk about other things which may not be as important, like, you know, the impost on crayfish or wine, but it has nowhere near as much significance as the iron ore. All right. Very good research there, Dave. I'm very impressed, mate. You should hand this in, mate. This is fantastic. So, Kate, you deal with the day-to-day property stuff. You're out there with buyers, and there are some differences between those people of Chinese heritage and those Australian buyers with property preferences, aren't they? Because I find when my students first come over, but when I say my students, I mean my Chinese students, you know, they're all into, oh, you know, we should be buying apartments and brand new.
Yes.
And I say to them, well, that might have worked where you're from and many other Asian nations as well.
Yep.
But in Australia, that doesn't work like that because our culture is not focused on brand new and apartments.
Yeah.
Hey, did you want to elaborate on that?
I sure do. There's a saying, when in Rome, do what the Romans do. And and I think it's important to remember what that really means. When you're looking for investment potential in a property, you'll get the strongest performance out of it when you go for something that has really strong owner-occupier appeal. So that's counter to a lot of people's thinking. And, you know, I go through a number of properties and sometimes I'll get a phone call from a real estate agent saying, oh, it's a ripper, it's a really good investment property. What he's saying is it's really crappy and none of the home buyers want it, but you could flog it to an investor. And that's not how I work. But the important thing to note is when you are in a particular community, if you're investing in property in that community, you've really got to be thinking about what the broad consensus is and, you know, what do the buyers get really emotional about? And here in Australia, we get really emotional in our inner city, in a ring, we get very emotional about period properties. And, you know, they get your hearts beating stronger, they get you bidding harder at auction, they get more people fighting over them. So that is one reason why when I'm talking about capital growth for my investor clients, I will often target a beautifully presented period property in a great street. Now, you introduce complexity when a cultural value or a difference of opinion clashes with that recommendation. Because if in another country, brand new is considered more highly prized, whether it be that ego's attached to it or whether there's just a broad acceptance that new is best and that's what you pay the hardest for, then you're working counter to your own set of beliefs. And I often have to have that difficult conversation. And Pete, you asked me about Chinese born or new arrivals, and that is a very strong sense of you know what they want in their criteria. But if I'm dealing with someone who has either really thought long and hard about it and sees my point of view, or maybe they're second or third generation, then the conversation is different. They will be open to an older property. And the same can be said for weatherboard. I often find, you know, in 99% of cases, and I know I'm generalising here, a Chinese buyer will upfront say to me, I don't want weatherboard. And that's because in China, that's not considered a property that you'd be ultra proud of. It's not something that you'd rush towards. So we've got these nuances that we're dealing with, and we have to always be respectful and understanding and talk about it in the way that it needs to be spoken about. If it's a home, no problem. If it's an investment, though, we have to talk about the importance of when in Rome, do what the Romans do.
And, you know, there are nuances through all cultures,
yes,
isn't there?
Absolutely.
And there are nuances throughout Australia, and there are nuances throughout regional way of life and city living and farmers and city folk. And
totally.
So something I've thought a bit about in terms of the style of property and how that evolves with the people that come to your country. And I think I've heard Bernard Salt talk about how Australia's preference for al fresco living and the open plan living out to the backyard came from our European migrants. Yeah, I'd be interested in your thoughts on, Pete. And, you know, so actually the structural shape and the way we've, you know, adjusted or renovated our homes have started to lean towards some of those European tastes.
Mm.
And I think it's only natural that some of the Asian tastes will start to build in because over time, obviously, the proportion of people with Asian heritage are going to get larger and larger. What are your thoughts on that, particularly on the European, I guess, influence?
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. I mean, because I mean, my mum and dad came over from Greece, but I was born here. But I have seen just in the 60 years that I've been around, I've seen a huge difference. Like when I was growing up, if somebody said, let's go out for a drink, it was out to the pub. Now when somebody says, let's go for a drink, it means let's go to a cafe. But back when I was growing up, there were no cafes. The only place you could get a coffee, just a coffee, right? We're not talking about a meal and then a coffee, was there was one place in the CBD of Adelaide, it was a pizza bar, and they would serve Italian coffee or cappuccinos. We're talking now back in the 70s. And then we started to eat outside. You know, outdoor dining was not a thing, you know. And I look at it now, you know, on a cold winter's day, there are people sitting outside with rugs drinking coffee. I mean, logically, that doesn't make sense, but that's what we want to do. But certainly the European culture has been a greater influence on Australian culture than, say, the Asian culture, because the Europeans have been around for a lot longer in Australia than people from many different Asian countries. But you're right, that'll slowly change, and there will be some things that we, when I say we, those of us that were born here, maybe our parents were born here, would do that looks closer to the Asian culture than what it used to be.
I'm loving watching my daughter, who's nearly 15, and, you know, she's socialising with her friends, and they've got pocket money now, and some of them are just starting to get jobs. And when they hang out, they go out for bubble tea, and it's the best.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
that's
they
a big
head
thing
into it. I love it. Yeah. Absolutely love it. And, you know, the idea of grabbing sushi, it's cost-effective. The kids can sit down and have their bubble tea and their sushi, and it doesn't require me giving her $50 and not seeing any change from it. And I think the influence, you know, socially and with our food and drink, it is fantastic. And that's broader than Chinese. It's an extended number of Asian countries that have given us that fabulous influence. But, yeah, I think we're seeing a lot of changes. And even just this weekend I did an inspection with clients of mine who bought a property in Northcote, and they were really excited to see an external section of the property where, you know, the barbecue was set up. And interestingly, it was a German and Greek vendor couple who were selling to my clients, one of which is Chinese. And she said, oh, how fantastic, we've got a wet kitchen. I love a wet kitchen because I love cooking traditional food and I don't like doing it in the house. And so we are seeing, you know, a lot of subtle and not so subtle influence in our housing styles, and I think it's a wonderful thing.
It's the kind of thing that architects should be thinking about and starting to build into their plans. Because
I've seen teppanyaki grills outside when I've visited, you know, beautiful newish homes, and that's, you know, a celebration of food when you're out on the deck and you've got a teppanyaki grill.
But I didn't have sushi until I was in my 20s, I think. My 7-year-old, 5-year-old and 2-year-old love it.
So we've only got about 5 minutes to go, but, Dave, I can see you've done a lot of research here, in particular on energy. I know coal has been one of Australia's largest exports to date, but we're moving to a cleaner and greener world. What can you say about that in relation to China?
Yeah, well, look, in relation to the question being highly dependent on China, and obviously we certainly need to transition from fossil fuels to clean and green energy. And that's going to take time, and fossil fuels, the reality, and coal is going to be used for probably a few decades to come, but ever diminishing. And, you know, that's not me saying that. That's, I think, one of the head energy councils in the world whose name escapes me. There we go, the International Energy Agency says that. We are a big chance to be able to lead this transition. And I'll just give you a few facts to keep it simple. You know, we're already the 6th largest copper producer in the world. And so raw materials are going to be key for batteries, motors and computer power. And we can be leaders in the provision of some of the key ingredients for these areas. So copper, nickel, lithium, iron, and rare earths. So we're the 6th largest producer of copper already. We're the 5th largest producer of nickel in the world. In terms of lithium, we're the world's top producer. And, you know, we're producing more rare earths as well. So the point there, without getting too deep into my thesis that I've written here, is there's plenty of opportunity if we have the ingenuity to take that opportunity over the coming decade. And then, you know, I haven't even mentioned hydrogen, which can be a clean, pure, zero emissions fuel. Every energy company and resources company in Australia is investing in hydrogen now. So we're trying to certainly lead the way there as well. So long story short, we have the potential to transition away from that reliance on not only China, but just, income from fossil fuels more broadly.
So, Kate, anything else you wanted to add there before we move on to our gold nuggets?
Yeah, I think if we talk about buyer behaviour, you know, a lot of our listeners are keen to know what happens to the coalface and how they can equip themselves to buy better. If you're purchasing in an area where you've got really strong Chinese interest, you've got to be really mindful of the aspects of a property that could really attract someone strongly if they're looking at, you know, feng shui, lucky numbers, community around them. They're some of the things that are really critical to understand before you just launch into purchasing a property, because you've always got to anticipate the competition that you could have, and you've also got to think carefully about bidding styles. And I think it can be a really worthwhile exercise to go and watch some auctions in your area and see how the agents facilitate, see how Chinese bidders are aided when the bidding starts. We often have an agent penciling on a big chart or having it on a big screen because the numbers are flying quickly. And as you can imagine, if you went into another nation and you were bidding quickly and having to get your head around numbers, 550, 500, 5,000, 5 million, it happens very quickly. So hence we see pencilers helping out a lot because we're often dealing with people who this isn't the first language and it's moving so fast. So being familiar with how an auction can feel in a very Chinese-centric area is really critical because it's quite different to a lot of other auctions.
Excellent. Thank you for that, Kayla. We're going to move into our gold nuggets very shortly, but if I could just sum up, there was one quote that Dave said that I think really brings it home for me. So the question is, Australia's economy is highly dependent on China. Do you see immediate risk in the housing market? Should China reduce dependency on Australia's supply chain? And the thing that brings it home to me is, China buys about 70% of the iron ore Australia exports, right? Which means we're very dependent on them. However, in turn, it makes up 60% of all the iron ore that China imports. So that makes them very dependent on us. So, you know, as much as we might see in the media and hear in the media what's happening between the Australian, a bit some tensions between the Australian government and the Chinese government, the reality is we depend on them. They depend on us. So thanks for that, Dave. I'm going to sleep very well tonight, knowing that things are going to be okay.
And it's amazing how when two nations or two people depend a hell of a lot on each other, well, yeah, occasionally there are some tensions.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. No one wants to depend too much on anyone else.
So thanks for that, Kate and Dave, but please don't go away, listeners, as we have our gold nuggets coming up.
If you've enjoyed our podcast, leave a review on iTunes and share the episode with your friends.
Now it's time for us to go mining for our gold nugget property tip of the day.
Kate, what's your gold nugget?
I want to chat about lucky and unlucky numbers, because if you are active in a market where lucky and unlucky numbers is a common conversation, you might find that the house with the number 8 or 88 or 81, it goes well and truly beyond expectations. And I know a lot of people roll their eyes and wonder if that's really true, but it is. And likewise, if you're not fazed by lucky or unlucky numbers, it might pay to put some attention into hunting down the numbers that have fours and ones in them, because they're not considered lucky numbers. In fact, they're unlucky numbers for a lot of Asian cultures. So if you're missing out and you've thought hard about it and you're open to exploring numbers, that might give you a little bit of an edge.
Right.
Dave, what's your gold nugget?
Yeah, I think we're very fortunate that we have a big, massive land for a relatively small population, and that's fundamentally our core advantage. I call it Australia's high land to asset ratio advantage. And I think it's something that we actually shouldn't take for granted. It allows us to live the standard of life that we live currently. We've transitioned from wool to wheat to coal to iron ore, and I certainly back Australians and their ingenuity to make the next transition to clean and green energy and continue to be a prosperous nation moving forward.
Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Dave. Thank you, Kat. If I could give a special thanks to my student, Li Zhang, for her permission to use some of the information from her dissertation on Chinese buying property in Australia. Thank you. And like I said, Dave, you've helped me sleep well tonight, knowing that we depend on each other. And like in any relationship, there are tensions, but things blow over, especially if you do depend on each other. All right. Thank you very much, Kate, and thank you very much, Dave.
If you've enjoyed this episode and would like to learn more about what impacts property prices, take a listen to episodes number 12, Property Cycle Management. Why now is always the best time to buy if it suits your personal economy and you have a long-term property plan. Episode 19, Time in the Market versus Timing the Market. Episode 42, Dissecting 10 Years of CoreLogic Data, Capital Cities and Regional Areas. Episode 71, Capital Growth, What Increases Property Value. And finally, Episode 72, Property Prices, What Causes Values to Fall and How to Tackle a Rising Market.
Thank you for joining the property planner, David Johnston, whose company Property Planning Australia provides the only independent pure planning advisory in Australia that does not buy or sell property, insurance, investment or super product.
And the property buyer, Kate Bacos, recently awarded Buyer's Agent of the Year and an owner of an independent buyer's agency in Melbourne's Inner West. And of course, the property professor, Peter Kalizos, Australia's leading property university lecturer, Chairman of Property Investment Professionals of Australia and seasoned investor and developer.
We've really enjoyed delivering this podcast and we'd love you to join us on our podcast webpage at propertyplannerbuyerandprofessor.com.au or our Facebook page. Feel free to send us any questions and Dave, Pete and I will answer them for you.
So until next time, remember that each property decision you make is leading you towards your ideal lifestyle.
Everything we talk about in this episode is general in nature and should not be considered to be financial advice. We've put a lot of effort into making sure the information is accurate, but please don't rely on this information to make a decision. If you're looking for specific advice, please seek the help of a specialist and remember, it's important you determine your trusted advisors are independent.